Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Another beautiful day in the region for sure. Thanks for joining us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, farmers Bill Hale and Aaron Crowder talk harvest, markets, and life in producing egg. And that will be in our weekly Prairie Plate segment. Plus, Annie Beck from the North Dakota Gateway to Science talks about science at home and brings easy, hands-on science fun for the whole family. Main Street begins today with our monthly Philosophical Currents segment, where we take a deeper look at the ideas behind the news. Joining me is my friend, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota and host of Why? Philosophical discussions about everyday life, a podcast and radio show that we air monthly here at Prairie Public. And today we're exploring happiness and asking if it can be learned or shared across cultures. Why this topic? I noticed that Finland had just been named the happiest place on earth yet again, and that makes several years in a row the Finns top the world in how satisfied they are with their lives. So, what's their secret? Is it something in the Finnish way of life, their social policies, or maybe even their state of mind? And importantly for today, can happiness be taught or transferred from one culture to another? I often wonder whether being happy is more about adding joy to our lives or taking things away that make us unhappy. And Finland, it seems to me, we're going to learn more about this, seems to excel at the latter. They have very few people living in misery or extreme unhappiness, thanks in part to strong social support systems. Does that mean the key to a happy society is reducing suffering rather than chasing bigger highs? Or do we need a mix of both less pain and more pleasure? We'll discuss these questions today. Jack, welcome back to Main Street.
Happy to be here. You've set quite an agenda for us in our little conversation.
Well, I'm glad you are happy to be here, Jack. Finland, as I noted, keeps ranking as the world's happiest country. Why do you think that is?
You know, it's very interesting because there is always a slew of these articles every year when Finland is announced number one. They're always written in this sort of wry, jokey tone. And in the background, there's some suggestions. And in the foreground are always silly things like the article you shared with me. The guy was learning how to make bird boxes and stuff. Not that that's a bad thing, but I'm not sure that that makes you happy. And also, I've spent a bunch of time in Finland, although not recently. I used to teach graduate seminars at the University of Helsinki. I went to the University of Oulu to do some lectures. I really like Finland, and I have some Finnish friends, and I actually miss it. I'd like to go back. But Finland is full of contradictions, because on the one hand, it consistently is number one in this World Happiness Report. On the other hand, historically, it has a very high suicide rate, although they've done a really good job of cutting that down in the last few years, also has a fairly high alcoholism rate. The winters are very long. It's pretty similar to North Dakota in that respect, although they get more snow. And a friend of mine from Finland actually said that the snow is really a wonderful thing because it makes the nights and the days lighter. That you know, they have darkness for 12 hours a day, right? They're in Oulu. It's very, very far north. So the snow is a necessity. So on the one hand, you have this description of them as a very, very happy society, and as individuals is very, very happy. And on the other hand, you have these complexities and these contradictions. And what does it mean? And so I guess there are two basic questions that we have to ask. The first is, what do we mean by happiness and how do we experience it? And the second is it measurable? Is it quantifiable? How do we study happiness in a way that gives us information? And both of those are on the table in this conversation.
Let's take the first question first. What is happiness? And is it a matter of less suffering, more joy? And I think about the sitcom Friends. They have these Friends moments all the time. You know, they're always generally happy, adding joy to their life, maybe a little less suffering too. Which is most important relative to happiness?
So this is one of those questions that has actually haunted the history of philosophy. The study of happiness has been around almost as long as we have documentation of Western philosophy. And the person who really is the foundation of these discussions is Aristotle, who lived about 2,400 years ago. But interestingly is the Epicurean discussion, because when they first defined happiness, they defined it as the absence of suffering, which is what you're describing. But what's the absence of suffering? Death. So Epicureanism started to advocate for suicide because it would be the happiest state. So they refined the definition to make pain the absence of pleasure, as opposed to pleasure the absence of pain. And what I did there, by the way, was a little sleight of hand, which is I substituted the word pleasure for happiness. And one of the things that Aristotle tells us, and one of the things that has guided this discussion, is that happiness and pleasure are not the same thing. Pleasure, joy, contentment, these are terms that describe feelings. They're terms that describe a particular experience. But happiness is something longer. Happiness is something over time. One swallow does not make a spring, to misquote the phrase. So I'll give you an example that I often present to my students. Imagine you are a new mother. This would be harder for you and me than some of our audiences, but imagine you are a new mother and it's 2 weeks into having a child and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you are holding your newborn as she breastfeeds. And you are exhausted and you're overwhelmed and you're terrified and you're body hurts and is sore from the breastfeeding and you're just completely just overwhelmed by the whole thing. Many mothers will describe that instance as one of the happiest moments in their lives. Now, how do you reconcile those two things? How do you reconcile the fact that you are in pain and overwhelmed with this sense of overwhelming happiness and overwhelming joy? And so what that suggests is that happiness is much more about meaning. It's much more about long-term goals. It's much more about the process that we engage in. And again, following Aristotle, the way that I always summarize it to my students is happiness is a doing, not a feeling. Happiness is an activity as opposed to a state of mind. And that changes the conversation completely.
But eliminating the negatives, the bad stuff in our lives over an extended period of time, and increasing, if we can, those things that make us pleasure, that we find pleasure in, must equate to better odds of being happy. Would you agree?
Almost certainly. And one of the things that the Finland discussion brings out that Aristotle does not talk about as explicitly because it wasn't a pre-modern idea is the fact that the structure and the institutions that we live in set the foundation for happiness. No matter how optimistic of a human being you are, you can't be happy in Gaza right now, right? No matter how optimistic you are, it's very, very hard to be happy in extreme poverty or insecurity. And so one of the things that underlies the Finland discussion is the fact that Finns are very secure in their healthcare. Finns are very secure in their education. Finns are very secure in their public safety. Finns trust one another. Social trust is tremendously important in terms of happiness. Finns have a reasonable, skeptical, but satisfying relationship with their government, although obviously that, you know, ebbs and flows with politics. I think about what's on my mind right now. Right? And I think about the things that prevent me from being happy. And one of them is the university and professors are under attack politically right now. And anything I can say can be used against me. That makes my life precarious. That makes me unhappy. The healthcare system is not particularly good. And although I have good health insurance, at any point I could reach the end of that, or an accident or cancer could mean bankruptcy. You know, that makes things precarious. I worry about drunk drivers. I worry about school shootings. I worry about all of these different things. And so every one of us has these circumstances that we face. And so the question is, do we feel safe or protected enough from these accidents of life, from these insecurities, that we can focus on other things? Can we focus on our relationships? I have someone very close to me who has just finished cancer treatment, and I'm very worried that it will be, you know, unsuccessful, but also the experience of the treatment was really terrible for him. That preoccupies me. I think about it all of the time. So how do I work on my intimate relationships? How do I work on my relationship with my wife? How do I preserve my relationship with my daughter, who is now studying abroad in Italy and feels very, very far away? How do I make time for friends? How do I take care of myself when I am worried about all of these things? So all of this is to say, you're absolutely right, that despite what the Epicureans say, the absence of pain, or the absence of, I'll say, threat or vulnerability, is a precondition for happiness. And Finns don't feel vulnerable in the way that Americans do. And they certainly don't have that experience every day, every hour. Most people in the world, when they drop their kids off at school, don't have that moment that all American parents have as they're driving or walking away, which is, am I going to see my child again? It's very, very hard to be happy in that context.
So there are deep cultural factors then that make, and I'm using air quotes, Finnish happiness maybe unique to the Nordic context. Perhaps there are other cultures that excel as well. But then can we, as I asked in my introduction, can happiness, the culture, be copied? Can it be exported? Why wouldn't everyone want to dwell on how to make us all happier?
Well, I'm going to offer two different paths for that conversation, one that I'll reject and one that I'll follow through. The first one that I'll reject is, I don't know. Why don't people want to make the government protections stronger? Why don't we want to improve our healthcare system? Why don't we want better education? That's a political conversation, right? And that ends up being partisan, and it has economic interpretations and all that sort of stuff. So I want to put that question aside. But there is a deeper question, again, that stems from early Greek philosophical discussion, and this is how they frame it, and I'll explain what this means. The question is, can virtue be taught? And what the question means is, can you teach someone to be ethical, or is it something that they have to practice, habituate, become a part of their life, much in the way that learning a second language becomes an intimate experience over a very long period of time? Now, why is that relevant? Because happiness has always been a part of the conversation of ethics in philosophy. Happiness is a moral question. We want to be happy because we think it's the good life. We want to be happy because it's part of what makes us a good person. We want to be happy because we treat other people better when we're happy, and we want other people to be happy, not just because they treat us better, but because we want what's good for other people. So this question of whether or not you can be a good person through education is one of the more complex questions, and what it means. You know, there's the old expression, You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And there's a Ben Harper song where he changes the line to, you can give a man an education, but you can't make him think, right? You can give people the tools, but only people can exercise them. Then there's a second part of that, which is what gets called the unity of the virtues. And what that means is, can you be good in one area of your life without being good in the other? Can you be a truthful person without being a just person? Can you be a just person without being a beautiful person, understood largely? Can you be a beautiful person without being, for Aristotle and Plato, a moderate person? Is it possible to be good in one area without being good in all areas? So when we ask happiness, we have to ask not just, can you be happy at work and not happy at life, but rather, can you be a happy person, or can you have a happy society if there isn't justice, if there isn't fairness, if there isn't security, if there isn't commitments to truth and exploration and the human condition. Happiness is embedded in all of those circumstances, and that's part of what makes it so hard.
We're enjoying our monthly philosophical currents discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota and host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which is a podcast and a radio show that we air every month here at Prairie Public. Jack, I want to ask you about money and happiness, if we can go there. And then I'm going to ask you about the cultural transfer of happiness as we wrap things up. All right. We all want to be happy. Studies show, though, that the more materialistic we get, the less happy we become. Why is that?
There is a threshold in which the rate of return starts to go down. And here's what that means. You need money to be happy up to a point, right? You need rent. You need food. You need access to transportation to get to your job, right? You need these basic things. You want to be able to pay for your child's education. You want art on your walls or whatever, right? You need money up to a certain point. But after a certain point, these necessities become conveniences and conveniences become luxuries. And what ends up happening for most people is that once they start acquiring a lot of money, their vision of life becomes acquiring more money. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, an endless cycle of I want more, I want more, I want more. I'll get back to that in just a second. Additionally, it becomes very, very easy when you have a lot of money to be in situations where you can indulge the worst parts of you, or the selfish parts of you. One of my theories about why so many rich people get into so much trouble, why, Woody Allen gets into trouble for doing what he does, and Elon Musk gets into trouble for doing what he does, and Harvey Weinstein, et cetera, is that the richer and more powerful you get, the fewer people you have to say no to you. And no is very, very important, because we all push boundaries. We all try to cross the line. We all, in one way or the other, try to grab the things that we shouldn't have. And when people say no to us, when society says no to us, it is often, not always, but often a form of protection, a form of stopping our self-destruction. When you get a lot of money, and when you have power especially, you have the ability to destroy yourself in ever-increasing ways. And that means that you are going to be in pain, you're going to be in fear, you're going to be indulging the worst parts of you, you're going to be exploiting others. And this goes back to that question of happiness. How does happiness connect to goodness, and what does it mean to be a good person? Money is, my father, when I was growing up, used to say, rich or poor, it's nice to have money. and there's a truth to that. You need money up to a point. But after a certain point, the question isn't whether you have money. The question is, what do you do with it? Now, I want to go back to something I said a minute ago, which is this idea that we compare ourselves to others. There was a very interesting study that I want to track down that I read years ago that was one of my favorite pieces of information. And I might have mentioned it on the show before. There was a study done of African-American soldiers after they came back from World War II. And they assumed that the African-American soldiers in the North would be happier than the African-American soldiers in the South, because their conditions were better in the North and Jim Crow dominated in the South. They actually found the opposite, that the Southern soldiers were happier. Why? Because in the North, the African-American soldiers were at the bottom of the rung. There was no one underneath them. In the South, there was still people underneath the soldiers, and that was African-Americans who didn't go to the army, African-Americans who were still sharecroppers, African-Americans who were still really suffering and were the bottom of the bottom. And what the study argued is that part of what makes us happy is how we compare ourselves to other people. And one of the things that at least in American culture, because the study wasn't international, and the American culture was, we want to feel better off than some of our neighbors. We want to feel like we're in a better circumstance. When you are rich, you are constantly comparing yourself to the richest person in the world. You're constantly comparing to people who have more. I've seen a slew of articles, I don't know his name, about this person who is always described as the second rich person on earth, underneath Elon Musk. Can you imagine always being described as the second best?
In that context, Jack, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would be happy, but actually, one of the things that we know is that people who win the lottery almost always go bankrupt within the first 5 years. That this sudden influx of money, this sudden influx of ability, most people can't handle. Now imagine you're born and raised in that circumstance. How do you handle it then? Right? I feel like if someone gave me $5 million right now at 55 years old, I'll be 56 in a week, at 55 years old, I have enough self-control that I could handle it. But studies suggest that that's not necessarily the case, and that maybe I think too highly of myself. So money is an enabler. It's a tool for success. It's also a drug. And it's also something that we can use to abuse ourselves and others. And abuse, self-abuse, and abuse of others is never, ever on the path to happiness.
Yeah. Money as a drug is an appropriate metaphor, I think. Jack, as we wrap things up, what can the Finnish export to me? Perhaps I don't have control about what our country can consider, but I have control about what I can consider. Can they export anything to me, to us, so that we can be more happy?
One of the things that I loved about the Finnish culture was the speed and the time that people have for reflection and community. And one of the best things about Finland is the sauna experience. Everyone spends time in the sauna regularly. Everyone spends time in the sauna with their friends, regardless of sex or age. And everyone takes the time to be in the sauna. I remember at one point I went to Helsinki and I was coming out of the airport, and my friend Johanna, who was taking care of me and who was getting me to places I needed to go, he's talking on the cell phone, and this was the most Finnish experience I'd ever had. I didn't even get to say hello, and he held his hand up for me to stop talking, took the phone away, and said, "My wife wants to know if you need me to turn on the sauna." It was the most Finnish moment I've ever had. That experience of being in a place where your body is relaxed, where you're being healthy, but where you're also, you're contemplative, you're focused on your own needs, but you can also be with your community who supports and loves you. And you are naked. The visual differences, the class differences, the labels, the fashion, the working hard to put on your makeup and make your hair do whatever, all that's gone.
Melts
and
away.
What you are human beings, people, individuals, bodies and minds in an environment where they can be in harmony with yourself and with others. And man, that is an amazing experience that we could all learn from.
Jack, we'll leave it there. Jack Russell Weinstein. We have a monthly segment called Philosophical Currents that we enjoy our discussions with Jack. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota and also host of Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, a radio show that we air monthly here on Prairie Public, and about to have a birthday. Jack, we'll be the first to wish you an early happy birthday next week. Thanks.
Thank you very
so much for joining us on Main Street.
It's always a pleasure. It's one of the highlights of my month. My man is smooth like Barry, and his voice got bass. A body like Arnold with a Denzel face. He's smart like a doctor with a real good rep. And when he comes home, he's relaxed with pep. He always got to get...
Still ahead on Main Street, farmers Bill Hale and Aaron Crowder talk harvest, markets, and life in producing egg. Plus, Annie Beck from the North Dakota Gateway to Science brings us easy, hands-on science fun for the entire family. It's a beautiful day here on Main Street. Lots more to come. Stay with us.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Apple sauce and some nice red beets.
You're listening to Prairie Plates here on Main Street. It's served weekly, and I have two special guests today. We're going to talk a little bit about farming and where food comes from, and these are special guests of mine, Bill Hale and Aaron Crowder. Bill is from near Amenia, farms near Amenia, and Aaron farms near Regent, North Dakota, where my dad's side of my family's from. Welcome, gentlemen.
Well, good morning.
Don't talk with your mouth full.
We'll talk about
good morning.
We'll talk about spaghetti in a little bit. Well, guys, it's great that you're in here. Let's talk about what you guys grow a little bit. We'll start with Aaron.
Well, you know, I'm on a farm, a small family farm. You know, what I grow is a family. I mean, that's what I grow. But my commodities that I grow for market, number one is durum, the hardest of all the spring-planted cereal grains. I grow canola, which goes to the food market also for the oil. I grow corn, which goes to the ethanol plant for the biofuels. And then I raise flax, which goes to the food market also.
And how many acres do you farm? Is it north of Black Butte? I've been to your farm a few times.
I'm in Rifle Township, and I'm a small farmer. We're right under 3,000 acres.
Hmm. Bill? Your turn.
Why am I not surprised Aaron is from Rifle Township? That sounds just about right. I'm actually a retired farmer, retired in 2020. My son and my brother now run the, about 4,000-acre farm. Grow sugar beets, spring wheat, not durum. Used to grow durum. Then it started raining in 1993. And so a lot of soybeans and corn.
Well, fellas, how was harvest this year? You know, Bill is from the eastern side of North Dakota. Aaron's from the western side of North Dakota. I strategically had these gentlemen on just because of the dichotomy of this east and west in North Dakota. But, Aaron, how is harvest this year? Give us the report.
Well, you know, we break harvest into two sections. You know, we've got the cereal grains, those small broadleaf crops. That harvest is pretty much done. And then next is the row crops. And that'll be probably another 30 days from now. But that small grain harvest came off really well. You know, we were very fortunate this year. We had large amounts of rain in certain areas of the western North Dakota. You get up to the Williston area, it's a little drier. But in the southwest, on my farm, we usually average 13 to 14 inches of rain. I had over 25 inches.
Wow.
So that meant we had yield. Quality for the most part is good, but our protein in our hard red spring wheat is down from a 14 average, probably down to a 13.1.
And for those who don't know, protein is really important with small grains.
Very important, because it's one of those characteristics that's used in making the breads or the products from that flour. You want that high quality from the hard red spring wheat.
So your bread flour is higher protein, your all-purpose is less protein.
Yep, and that's usually from the, you know, southern United States. It's that hard red winter wheat, okay, versus the hard red spring wheat, which we raise up in this part of the country.
Bill, how was harvest this year?
It was not too bad. Aaron needs to learn how to share in terms of rain.
Usually it's the east that's yes. Wet.
Oh, yes, and we had a couple of dry spells. Sugar beets were really hurt on our farm. First time I've ever heard of it. Anybody who planted sugar beet seed 3/4 of an inch deep, really shallow planted crop, on April 23, 24, and 25, I've heard, when we had that about a week of 90s in May, it cooked the seedlings and killed them the crust of the soil. So they had to be replanted in May 16th, and then half to two-thirds of them didn't emerge until June 16th. And we just had pre-harvest with sugar beets on September 3rd, and my son's sugar beets, in spite of the fact they've only been out of the ground 2.5 months, produced 17 tons per acre, and they were 15% sugar. That's amazing.
But talking about the seed issue, mm-hmm. I don't think people understand the challenges of, well, big production ag, mm-hmm. regular ag, organic farming, all of these things. They're used to just buying food at the grocery store that looks great and tastes great. But one of those challenges, I think, is hail, and we call it, you know, the white combine, right? And I had some reports from Mott, North Dakota, where there was some hail in that area. Did that affect you at all, Aaron?
Yep. That line came from Belfield area straight across the state, and it hit us in that Hettinger-Stark County line, right?
Yeah.
Where Rifle Township ends and goes into Stark County.
I know there's a butte right by there, right at the sign.
Yep. So the hail did come. A lot of those producers in that area had 100% loss.
Wow.
The adjusters came out, looked at the field, and said, don't even take a combine out. I mean, it's 100% loss.
And at that time of year, you can't replant. You're done.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you've worked on, spent all that money on, borrowed all that money on, it's all gone. There's hail insurance that'll help pay off some of those costs of planting it, but not all of it.
It doesn't make you whole. And there's steps to crop insurance,
mm-hmm.
different. Are there any crops, or is there a crop that, Bill, that you really like to grow?
Well, I really like sugar beets. You know, they're typically a third of the acres on our farm and half of the income.
Well, they say that the sugar beet plant in Moorhead that smells from time to time, most people say it smells like money.
I prefer to think of when the payloader backs up to put a load of beets into a truck for the truck to haul them to the factory, that beep, beep, beep is the Brinks truck backing up. And we work really hard to control odor. We put a foot of straw over those ponds, and we also use semi-loads of industrial-strength Febreze, and it works.
I don't know if you're kidding around
I'm not.
Wow. Interesting.
A lot of money and should do that to be a good neighbor.
Well, it drives the economy around here. Ag is definitely the driver, energy as well, but ag has always been the stalwart in North Dakota and the Dakotas and the upper Midwest. Aaron, is there a crop you really like to grow?
Honestly, I like growing them all, but one that just historically sticks out for my father and for me is the durum. The durum wheat, it's the hardest of all the kernels of all the different classifications of wheat, and it's ground into semolina and pasta, and I love pasta.
Yeah.
My granddaughters love pasta.
I do, too. You always say you're a spaghetti farmer. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you're proud of your profession. You're proud of what you do, and we raise high-quality durum. And it goes to the millers. It goes to Carrington. It goes to Grand Forks. It goes to places in Minnesota. And, when we go out to eat, people start talking about what they do for a living. And I say, I'm a spaghetti farmer. And they give me that look like, what's this guy talking about? Spaghetti, that doesn't grow on a plant. And then I explain to them the process of durum ground into semolina. Semolina is made into the pasta, and there's 400 different types of pasta shapes around the world, and then all of a sudden these people just go, I never knew that. Well, it's fun to talk about it because then it's a conversation thing, and I walk out of there thinking these people learned something and they're going to tell their friends about they know this spaghetti farmer in North Dakota. But when you think about it, 80% of all the durum growing in the United States is in the upper Great Plains of North Dakota, a little bit in Minnesota, a little bit in Montana, but that's where it comes from, folks.
Hmm.
There's a lot more to tell, but it's interesting. October's pasta month. Get ready.
I'll eat a lot of pasta. I'm a quarter Italian, so I'll say mangia, which means eat. Crops in North Dakota aren't just grown to consume for humans. They're grown for energy. And Aaron, I know in your area, a lot of farmers bring their corn to the ethanol plant in Richerton. Are you a part of that?
Yes. I never really raised corn until I had that market. because previously it would always just go for livestock feed, and now it can go for that ethanol plant. And now, you know, we couldn't grow enough corn in southwest North Dakota, so we had to ship in corn to the ethanol plant. And their basis, which is to me the transportation cost, was a positive basis. So if the futures market was at $4 and they had an 80-cent basis, I got paid $4.80, and it happened a lot. Well, through technology and innovations of varieties of corn and farming practices, you know, we're growing some huge corn crops. Well, we can now supply a lot of corn to that ethanol plant. And that ethanol plant, there's a long story and a long history about the carbon sequestration that they do at their two wells, how they are available for some of these federal credits, refundable credits. So Red Trail Energy was recently sold. But I still have a market. I don't have those bases, which is something we need to talk about in soybeans.
We do.
So I grow corn, and it's a forgiving crop. It's just amazing what I can grow with that. And then all of it gets marketed to the ethanol plant. And out of the ethanol plant comes your ethanol, it comes your dry distiller's grain, and then your CO2 gas. Those are the three things that come out of an ethanol plant, and that's what we're trying to work on.
And 20 years ago in southwestern North Dakota, you didn't see much corn, but with this ethanol plant, it all works together, and I'm sure that there's some added value things with that plant too. But before we go, gentlemen, I would like to talk about soybean prices and your thoughts on that. Bill, I'll start with you.
Well, the soybean market was pretty well destroyed 5 years ago with the last group of tariffs, and pretty much finished the job here within the last 4 or 5 months. The Chinese are so angry with us, I don't know if they're ever going to buy American soybeans again. And that's the huge part of the market for soybeans in the world.
Aaron?
Bill is spot on. The Chinese, their major, I can't say enough, exports are those consumables that the U.S. citizens buy. You know, the cheap stuff we want to buy. We want to buy the lowest price of things at whatever retail box store we can go to. That's their major export. And that's the thing that they want to continue. Now, do they want to import the feedstocks of soybeans? Yes. Well, what happened in the past when the last trade war took place, you know, they quickly realized that Northern Hemisphere, we get it 6 months, basically, in the United States. Southern Hemisphere, we get it 6 months, basically, from Brazil. They heavily invested in their business that they do with the Southern Hemisphere. And they have invested in ports, infrastructure, and all those things. So they built up that reliance and that relationships of trade with Brazil. And that has proved to them that it works. Well, in the last trade negotiations, there was verbiage in there that said that China was going to make these, phase one, are going to make all these purchases. But if you read the detail, it also says in there, based upon market conditions and economic values of China. Well, it was an out for them. And as we do this next round of trade deals, supposedly, there's going to be that same language in there, and China's probably not going to come back to make any purchases because they'll use it that as their economic out on it. So in my country, we don't raise a lot of soybeans. In Bill's country, it's a big crop, and that gets down to that basis. So if the market, futures market, says beans are at $10, $11, well, right now that basis in some places is $1.50, a negative $1.50, and it goes down, and pretty soon your beans are worth $8.50. You know, oh, but it may be higher at a crushing plant. Well, we don't have enough crushing plants or market for all those crushed products. So it's just a conundrum that we got this country into.
And Aaron is right. Four of the top five soybean-producing counties in the United States are in North Dakota. Been for 35 years.
These are interesting facts that people should know about, especially in North Dakota, where we just grow a vast amount of crops. And yeah, we have a lot of the top producing crops in the country. Gentlemen, it was great to have you in. This was a fun and informative session. This has been Prairie Plates here on Main Street, here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by LiveWire, a provider of live event audio, video, lighting, staging, and streaming services for events, conferences, and meetings across the Prairie region and around the country. More information at livewirenow.com.
And we continue Main Street on this Thursday. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Pleased to again be joined by Annie Beck from the North Dakota Gateway to Science. She's a STEM educator there. And today we are giving ideas for how to engage with your young one, or maybe even someone else at home, with STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Annie, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Big world out there, and it seems to me like such an easy thing to do, but sometimes we need a little kind of idea engagement, and that's why you're with us today. What do you have for us?
Absolutely. So this time of year is one of my favorite times of year in North Dakota. There is so much going on in our natural world. So today we have a few ideas for connecting science, art, and the nature around you.
All right, let's start.
So one of them is a color wheel nature walk. You know, we want to keep science and doing any STEM activities doesn't have to be something that costs a lot, is really complicated. This is something as simple as getting a color wheel and going for a walk. You know, seeing if you can find things around you that match with all the different colors. You know, this time of year where we still have all of the beautiful flowers, and the leaves are starting to change. I mean, there's color everywhere. So that is one fun idea. Along with that, leaf art. So collecting any leaf that has fallen and using your creativity to create whatever image you can, whether it's creating an animal, an insect, a house, whatever your imagination can come up with. And then another one is just a classic leaf and bark rubbings. So taking a piece of paper and a crayon, putting that bark or that leaf underneath the paper, gently rubbing it with the side of your crayon and seeing what comes up. You know, what I love about all of these is they are perfect for all ages. You know, for our youngest scientists, they are just excited about the discovery and the colors and talking about the adjectives of rough and smooth and all of those things. You know, for our older learners, you can go in depth into the phenology. You know, what do you notice that is changing in nature right now compared to last time you were out? You know, what is blooming or not blooming? What trees are changing color, or just what birds are you noticing at this time of year? And just asking those questions, being curious about the world around you as you're really taking the time to notice and to look closely.
Annie, you have a resources page available on your website. How can people access that? And what's there?
Yeah, we absolutely do. So gatewaytoscience.org. Under that, we also have little videos for Science at Home segments too, that we've been starting to do. So you can check those out for more ideas as well.
Annie Beck, she joins us each and every Thursday here on Main Street. We talk about what's new and maybe what's been there for a bit at the North Dakota Gateway to Science. Of course, that's in Bismarck. It's a beautiful structure just on the banks of the Missouri River. If you haven't been, now is a great time. Fall is a great time to go. Annie, thanks again for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Danielle Webster, and I'm from a small town in North Dakota, so community is pretty important to me. And so is knowing the scoop. Like about Phyllis's sauerkraut dinner coming up on Saturday in the church basement, or the local theater group's production this summer. That kind of thing. If you want to know what's going on, or you want to let people know what's happening in your neck of the woods, go to our community calendar at prairiepublic.org. You can learn all about exciting events across the region and get our listening audience-wise to your organization's events. Just go to prairiepublic.org/community.
You can tour the studios of some of Fargo Moorhead's most popular artists during the FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl. This free family event is October 4th and 5th, noon to 6 p.m. See painters, potters, sculptors, glass artists, fabric artists, jewelry artists, group studios, and more, all demonstrating their work. Peruse the Studio Crawl map at prairiepublic.org/community.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 1 is about sacred relatives. It states, Native people practice a deep interconnectedness with the land, the resources, the water, all living things, and all human beings. Land stewardship, respect for all two-legged, four-legged, winged, crawlers, and swimmers, and a strong belief in the sacredness of all human beings are key elements of our spirituality. In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll listen to Catherine Freilich, enrolled member of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, talk about traditional ways and values.
Spirituality has been the anchor for my family that's always helped us through all kinds of difficult challenges in life. And everything that you mentioned in there, my mother taught us about the traditional perspectives on that. So for example, she even says to this day, remember, on Easter morning, go out and get a cup of water from the pond or whatever, because everything is holy. Remember, water is holy. And we've always believed that, not just Easter time, but, you know, and so... And then at giveaways, she said, remember, when you give away a blanket, remember that that blanket should touch the ground because our earth is holy and sacred. Mm-hmm. And so you want to give that blanket, you make sure that that blanket is touching the ground before you give it to that person as a blessing. I mean, she taught us these things, and she was taught by her grandma and her grandma. So all of that was handed down. And then respect for animals, you know, in the creation stories. All our tribes have creation stories, and she shared the Arikara creation story with us as I was growing up. And it talked about, you know, our relationship with all, you know, elements of our earth, the animals, you know, and that at one time we could talk to the animals, and they could talk to us, and we could communicate with them. And so, yeah, growing up, I remember, you know, remember her talking about that. So I think that's really an important value that our kids are missing.
I'm Charla Stever. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous Elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org. Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra will open its 100th season on Saturday, October 4th at 7 p.m. in Ann Nicole Nelson Hall at Minot State University. The program will include the world premiere of Pagan Holiday, a work commissioned by the orchestra to celebrate its centennial season. The concert will also feature pianist Frederic Chu performing Prokofiev's Piano Concerto No. 3 along with Sibelius's Corelia Suite. Tickets and information at MinotSymphony.com.
Hi, I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. Prairie Public is the place you'll hear compelling conversations, music you're excited to discover, investigative, fact-driven journalism, and sound-rich storytelling. We bring you this kind of radio with the help of listeners like you, and without the help of advertisers. Help keep non-commercial public radio thriving in North Dakota. Become a sustaining member today by just going to prairiepublic.org. or call 800-359-4145. Again, that's 800-359-4145. Thanks so much.
And that wraps up this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us today. Coming up tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. His topic this week, why do you create? And at 7 p.m. Central, it's Science Friday with Ira Flato. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again Monday, right here on Main Street.